This is a presentation of LifePoint Church. Our mission is to make gospel-centered disciples of Jesus Christ. For more information, please visit sharethelife.org.
My name is Zach. I'm one of the pastors here, part of our preaching team, and I am thrilled this morning to start a brand new sermon series. I'm really excited about this sermon series, and as we begin, I want to tell you a little bit of a story that has stuck with me for years. And this story was told by the president of Denver Seminary, and it's kind of some of the inspiration for this particular worship sermon series. The president of Denver Seminary is Dr. Mark Young, and he tells this story. He was on a business trip, I believe it was at a conference, and he had a packed schedule at this particular trip. He worked late into the evening, and at the very end of the three-day trip, he had to jump right back onto a plane, and he was tired, frankly, just tired. So he got onto the plane. And I don't know how you get onto an airplane, but he is not maybe at this point the kind of social type that really wants to make small talk, and he wants to signal that. So he puts down his tray in front of him. He sets his kind of belongings on there, his case for his headphones. He's got his journal and his Bible, and he just sets it on the tray. It probably looked something like this. And then he pops in his headphones. And that's a clear social cue, like, I don't want to talk, right? Got my headphones in, I'm ready just to relax and take this plane ride home and get some rest. Well, shortly after he's seated there, his eyes are closed, he's ready to relax, a gentleman sits down right next to him who is a little bit more sociable. And even with headphones in, he turns to the president of Denver Seminary, he doesn't know this, and he sees this book sitting on his tray table, and he turns to him. And he asks him this very polite, casual question that many people would ask on a plane. He says, hey, what are you reading? What's that book about? Pulls out his headphones. This book? Yeah, what's the book about? What are you reading? This is the president of a seminary who doesn't want to be bothered, and he is now locked next to another person with the most simple, innocent question, and what can seem to be a very complicated, significant, all-consuming answer. What's this book about? That's a simple question, but I want you to imagine for a moment, and I know it's hard to imagine being on a plane during COVID, but imagine you are sitting on a plane and you're in Dr. Mark Young's shoes. Someone turns to you and they say, hey, what's that book about? What are you reading? How would you answer that question? Maybe it wouldn't happen on a plane, but I'm confident, and I know there are many people doing this, that maybe that question could come up on a long road trip that you're taking to go camping, because you just bought an RV and you got to squeeze in camping. That's the thing to do, right? It's a pandemic, you should buy a camper, you go camping, right? How would you answer that question on a road trip? How would you answer the question across the fence from your neighbor? Hey, what's that book about that you're reading? Simple, simple question, difficult answer. Maybe you're here today in the room, or maybe you're watching online, and that's a question no one has ever asked you, but it's a question that you've asked, actually. Maybe you've been to a hotel room before, you've pulled the drawer, right, and you've seen the black Bible that's still got the no bend in the back of the Bible, right? You crack it open, and you've whispered to yourself just before you fall asleep in that hotel, what is this book about? What is this thing? That's one significant question that we aim to answer over the next 6 weeks. And I just want to be explicit with you. If you call LifePoint home, I'm just going to tell you what our goals are. All right? We're not going to hide them in the background. We pick sermon series well in advance, and we plan with intent. And so we want to share that intent with you. We have some goals for this series. And first, we want to say this. Our hope is that by the end of this series, every person who's going to journey with us will be able to answer that question. What's this book about? That's it. Every person. And if you're a Christian, that's a really critical question for you to be able to answer, because we want you to be able to answer that question, not just for yourself, but so that you could share that answer with somebody else. So this is not a series for us to gather more knowledge to collect dust on the shelves of our brains. This is a series to be equipped with tools to be able to speak the answers to this question, what's this book about? And so I want to invite you to do something right now. If you are a Christian and you belong to this church, I want you to think of a name, one person. And this is a person, maybe the Spirit already right now, it's just kind of stirring in your heart. You're thinking of somebody. And this is one person you could imagine having that conversation with. You could imagine them maybe having a conversation that's asking this question, what's this book about? Who is that person in your life? Maybe it's a family member on that road trip. Maybe it's a coworker. I want you to think of that person. And for the next 6 weeks, I'm asking you to do this. Would you now commit to pray for that person? And we've found time and time again, and you just start praying for that person. You start thinking about them, praying for them, and God opens up an opportunity that maybe you could have that conversation with them. This is a practical series. And just as a side note, and I'll say this really personally, I know there's a global pandemic going around. And we've been talking about that quite a bit lately, right? We've been talking about God as our good shepherd. We've been talking about hope. And right now, I want to shift us into a different direction, because I'm noticing this about myself, is the more of the world that becomes anxious and stressful and uncertain, there's a tendency in my own heart to start to curl inward. Isn't it? Isn't this just a human response? Maybe you're not like me. But you just start to feel like you just got to preserve yourself. Look out for your own family. And this is a series to open our eyes, to remind us we have a great God who's for us, and we can be for people. We can be for others. And I'm praying that over this series, that this would take our gaze off of our own circumstances and look to others. I have a second goal for this series. That's the first, that you Christians would be able to answer this question. But it's important for us to answer this question, not only to be able to share the answer, but for us to be able to read the Bible correctly. Sometimes maybe you've seen a verse on like a coffee mug, or you got the Hobby Lobby art, right? The Hobby Lobby art, it's got like a nice verse and it rings, right? And it looks great in artwork. That Hobby Lobby verse cannot make coherent sense unless you understand the answer to the question, what's this book about? And so often we try to understand a particular verse out of context, and it's almost like a kid staring at a single piece from a puzzle. And he's looking at it and meditating on this particular piece of the puzzle, studying this piece of the puzzle in the original Greek and Hebrew, right? And the reality is sometimes we look at that piece of the puzzle so much we forget it's a part of a puzzle. And on the front of the box is the picture, the big picture, and how this piece of the puzzle fits with the big picture. This is what understanding the overview of the Bible does for us as we read the Bible. We can understand how the puzzle piece fits in the grand narrative. So that's our second goal, that we would have context as we go through. What is this book about? That's a simple question with a challenging answer. And I get it. It's challenging because this is not a simple book. In fact, there's 66 books in this book. And it's been written by over 40 authors over a 1,000-year time span in a culture that's well far removed from our own. I mean, this is ancient literature. Simple question, difficult to answer. But here's the amazing thing about this book. If I were to answer that question in the simplest terms, what's this book about? What would I start with? I would say this. This book, first and foremost, is a story. It's a story. And in fact, it's a true story. And all 66 books tell one unified, amazing, true story of everything that exists and why you're here and why I'm here and what's the point of life. That's this story. And over the next 6 weeks, we want to show you how this is all really a story. And so we're using, as for the entire series, a particular metaphor. And remember, this is a metaphor. So if you press any metaphor too far, it's going to break. So use it as just a metaphor. But we're using the metaphor of story to help us understand what this whole book is about. Now, is anybody here around like fifth or sixth grade? Do we have anybody middle school? Nice. Sweet. This is coming, all right? You're going to have a head start this year on online school or whatever that's going to look like. In fifth or sixth grade, I remember my English teacher teaching us the elements of story. Every story has them. There's elements, six basic elements to every story or plot line. Here they are. Here's every story that's ever told. You think about Frozen, the movie. This has all these elements. It starts with exposition. You get to know the characters and a little bit of the setting. And then early on in the story, there's inevitably a conflict. There's a problem that's created, some tension that needs to be resolved. And then there's this rising action, and the characters go through ups and downs, and you journey along with them. And every story ultimately comes to this wonderful climax. This is the big turn. This is where everything's going to be put on the line, and we'll see if it works out. After the climax, there's falling action, and it leads to a resolution. Is this kind of ringing a bell? Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is what's amazing about the elements of story. The original story follows those elements. Amazingly, I mean, take a look at this. Here's the Bible in six C words that follow this same pattern. The first C word, if we go to this next slide, is creation. Creation. This is the exposition, the beginning of the Bible. And then there's some tension that's introduced. There's a conflict. And we're using the word chaos to describe that. And then during the rising action, we're using another C word to help you remember, covenants. At the very climax of this story is another C word, Christ. The falling resolution is the church. And finally, I'm cheating here. I put an RE in front of it, recreation, to help you show how we're going back to the beginning. That is the entire Bible in six C words. And we're going to learn these words. So I'm going to say them briefly, and then you're going to say them with me through a muffled mask. Are you ready? And online, you don't have to do that. You can just shout them out, right? So here's the words. Say them with me. Six words. Creation, chaos, covenants, Christ, church, recreation. You're going to sneak that in. Sneak that in. That's great. You're going to be trying that every week for the next 6 weeks. This is the entire Bible in six C words. Today we're covering creation. Now, for just a moment, I want to speak to kiddos in the room and online. The Bible is a story, and there is an amazingly helpful book that's been published recently that our girls love reading, and now we have a boy as well. There's our newest right there. You got to squeeze that in there. So we read this story with our girls, Penny and Ella, and now we have James, and I'm telling you, this story, it gets read more than any other book in our library. It's been torn and taped repeatedly. It has Cheerios crushed into it. We love reading this particular story, and it's by a guy named Kevin DeYoung, and he partnered with an amazing artist. I've got a picture of the cover here, and it's called The Biggest Story by Kevin DeYoung. This is an amazing book for this sermon series. If you want to engage your kids in this sermon series, buy this book and read it. You can read one chapter a night. It's not very long, but it helps even young kids understand that the Bible is essentially a story. What I love, this is a great book for like elementary age. They could even read it themselves. There's a companion book too called The Gospel, The Biggest Story, ABCs, I believe. And it's like a cardboard kind of book. So James can gnaw on it, right, and chew on it. It's great. Check that out. Okay, kids, that's a way you can engage in this story. Tell your parents they owe you a book, all right? Let them know that, and you can read through that. Today, we're covering the first C word, creation. How does this story begin? What's the book about? It begins with this word, creation. Creation. Turn with me in your Bibles to Genesis 1:1. If you've never read this book, we're literally just turning to the very first page. First page, just like any story would begin, you begin at the beginning. Read these words carefully and read them through the lens of maybe someone who's never read this before, ever. And be amazed with me. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God. And if I could have some liberty as a storyteller, I might even put just in parentheses a little period right there after the fourth word of the entire Bible. In the beginning, God. This is how this story begins. If we use this metaphor, this book begins by explaining that God, in this metaphor of story, God is the author. He's the author. He is the one who's made this story. He's writing it. He's from the beginning, there isn't anything else but God. There's a lot of other ways this story could begin. Think of how, if you had a right for the very beginning of a story, especially a story as important as this, think of other ways that this story could begin. It says in the beginning, God, but I know there's a lot of people today that probably if they were gonna write the story of all that exists, of the universe, their story begins this way. In the beginning, matter. In the beginning, balls of gas. That's the beginning, right? Stuff existed and somehow sort of came together to form all of this over a very long time. That's a beginning. That's a storyline that many people believe today. If they were going to read this story, they might be surprised to see in the beginning God. But that's not how this story begins. It begins with God. Maybe you've heard this phrase. Have you ever heard somebody, they had a coincidence come together and they said, man, maybe the universe is telling me something. You know, I bumped into this stranger like 4 or 5 times today. I think the universe is telling me I need to marry them. The universe, right? Their story, how they live, their worldview is that in the beginning, the universe. The universe. Some abstract, impersonal something existed. But that's not how the Bible begins. There's a lot of people today that might even write the story this way. They think this story should start this way. In the beginning, humanity. People. We're the stars, right? On Earth, we're the big deal. We should be the centerpiece of this story. But it's simply not this story. What's this book about? First and foremost, this is a book about God. It's a book about God. There is no mention of humanity all the way until verse 25 of the first chapter. And in this first chapter, God is mentioned 35 times. The author of Genesis is getting a point across that this story, the story of all things, is about him. It's his story and what he's doing, not primarily your story and what you should do with your life. It's a story about God. This may seem elementary, but it is absolutely essential to understanding the rest of the Bible. If you miss this in the first 4 words, you will be frustrated reading this book because it can't do for you what it's not designed to do. I'll give you one illustration, how we read the Bible with context. If biblical history is his story, it's kind of the old cliche, it's his story, biblical history, this changes how we approach the Bible. When I read this, I'm reading his story to understand who he is and what he's about, not primarily who I am and what I'm about. So this is how this happens often. Maybe you're gonna go to 1 and 2 Samuel, you're gonna read about David, and you're amazed at this story. He's a cool guy. He killed a bear with his bare hands. I mean, he was a warrior, and you start reading him, and you go, this guy is worth following. Really like David. How could I be more like David? And everything's going fine and dandy, and you can even start to apply that to your own life. Got to be more like David. Got to have courage. Got to be a warrior king. And then you get to some icky parts in the story. And you see David sleeping with another married woman. And he, serious abuse of power. and then he goes and he has the husband of this woman who he's committed an affair with murdered. You're going to follow him. And we come to this point in the Bible and we say, what do we do with that? How am I supposed to apply that to my life? Try to do the good things that David does and try not to do the bad things. The Bible's not primarily about David. And the Bible's not primarily about you. This changes how we approach the story of David. Now when I read the story of David, we don't have to start there. We don't have to look to him as our model, but we actually ask this question, who is God and what is he doing in the story of David? At that moment, we're able to zoom out and we see the broader context of the story of David. We see a God who's been faithful and makes promises to a king, a particular guy who doesn't deserve it, but who will ultimately fulfill those promises later in the story. This changes how we read the Bible. So what are you reading lately, Christian, if you're reading the Bible? I want to challenge you. Maybe you're knee-deep in a genealogy, like First Chronicles, and you are barely awake. You're reading, and there's another name and another name, and maybe you've had this moment when you read the Bible, and you think to yourself, what is this for? He took up all these words to have me mispronounce all these names. And without the bigger context, that can become frustrating, but it changes the way you read a genealogy if we understand that this is his story and God is the author. Ask yourself that question as you read the Bible. If we use this metaphor of the story, not only is God the author, not only is he the author and this is his story, but God created the setting and he's done so to display his glory. Look at the next word of the first page of the Bible. Four words, in the beginning, God. God. This God is the one who is the Alpha and Omega, as Revelation 1:8 says, who is and who was and who is to come. Nothing precedes him. Nothing exists before him, and he will be in the end. This is the God, the author of all things. But notice what he does. In the beginning, God creates. He created the heavens and the earth. This is a wonderful piece of literary device, heavens and earth. It's not saying the heaven and a earth. This is a literary device to say all things. I mean, from the top to the bottom, this God who exists and is the author of all things has created all things from heaven down to earth. The microscopic plankton that wash up on the shore of a beach in San Diego, God made that. God made that. And the furthest star at the edge of the Milky Way galaxy, God made that. He's the one who's created the setting. And he's done this to display his glory. Psalm 19:1, I could go to a lot of places in the Bible, but I'll give you one. It says this, the heavens declare the glory of God. God could have made a utilitarian kind of world. Really functional. But he made it beautiful and amazing to reflect something of who he is. And we often fail to marvel at this. And just give you one illustration to marvel. You know, God's created the heavens and the earth. If he's really created the furthest star in the Milky Way galaxy, it goes on in the Psalms to say that he's not only made these stars, but that he's actually counted them. He's numbered them and named them. So I wanted to think through this, and I looked through an introductory book to astrology to find some little nuggets about the size of the universe. And so I asked this question, how long do you think it would take for someone to simply count the number of stars in one galaxy? That's our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. How long would it take to count those stars? Just one galaxy. If you gave yourself an average of 1 second for every number, and that's easier early on, but when you get into some of those really big numbers, that's hard because you're clicking along. 1, 2, 3, 4,570, okay, right? The whole way. How long would it take you?
100 years.
That's a good guess. I like that guess. And it's actually a lot more than 100 years. It would take you 3,000 years. Years just to count the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. There's no potty breaks for that. You don't have time to eat in 3,000. There's no sleeping. 3,000 years of counting to number the stars in one galaxy, and there's billions, billions of galaxies. And the psalmist says, this God who's the author of it all, who created the heavens and the earth, has not only numbered them, he's named them. Oh man, now my head hurts. Timmy, Susie, Googleplex, every star. This is the first 7 or 8 words of the Bible, and it should stun us. This is his story. He's the author, and he's the one who's created the glorious setting of this story so that people might say, wow, isn't our God great? But it's not just that he's the author of all things, and it's not just that he's created the setting. No, early on in our story arc, in this exposition or introduction to the Bible, God has actually created every character in his story as well. And that's where we skip down to verse 26. God does a lot of creating in the first 25 verses, and in verse 26, we come to the culmination of his creation. Look in your Bible with me. Verse 26 of chapter 1. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish in the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man, humanity, in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. This is amazing. Because it changes how you really live your life. This is quite a claim that the Bible is making. The Bible claims that you were created by an all-powerful, all-knowing, personable, good, and loving God who's the author of all things. Your life is not an accident. You were made. You were created. And that means you are a character in his story. And on the biblical timeline, you're maybe 70, 80, 90 years. I don't know if I get the scale just right. How close can I get my fingers? That's your life. It's not your story. Your character in his great story. But I want you to see from the opening pages of this book, God's grace on people. God has created humanity. And he blesses them, verse 28. And he says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea. Take up a fly rod and throw it into the Poudre River and yank out a fat rainbow trout. And over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth, God gives them purpose. Look at the grace that God has given them. And this is the worldview that's tough for us to understand. I think often we take our life for granted and we believe we are owed our own life. But that's not how the story of the Bible begins. It begins with a God who needed nothing and created people. He gave Adam and Eve breath in their lungs. And here's the thing. Because Adam and Eve didn't exist, they could not do anything to earn lungs. Nothing. Adam and Eve had nothing to bring to the table from the beginning of this story. It's God's grace that they even exist. That's grace. You don't deserve this. You didn't earn it. Here, breathe. But not just that, he creates a beautiful place, this garden with fruit and vegetables and plants and animals. He gives them provision from the opening pages of Genesis. And Adam and Eve are still trying to figure out that they exist. They haven't done anything to earn it. That's grace. But then God's grace gets poured out on them even further. And he says, you know what? I'm not going to leave you here to be bored. I'm going to give you a purpose, and it's a glorious purpose. I'm the author of all things who's created everything that exists out of nothing, and you get a job. Oh, and it's so fulfilling. You get to continue my creative work. Take this creation that I've started and make it better. Find oil in the ground and turn it into gasoline and invent an automobile that will take you further distances to see more of my creation. You're going to be a part of my work. He gives them a purpose. And everything that humanity receives is grace. It's grace. Undeserved, unmerited blessing and favor. Grace doesn't come later in the story. It's not just when you hit the New Testament. It's from the opening pages of the Bible. Don Carson, a theologian and well-known founder of the Gospel Coalition, he puts it this way, and I love the way he illustrates this. He says, the doctrine of creation sets the stage for the doctrine of grace. He's arguing you can't have one without the other. You can't skip the doctrine of creation. You won't be able to understand the doctrine of grace. So he illustrates it this way. He says a lot of religions today, whether you believe in a personal God or not, they function like a great exchange. Maybe you've prayed this way. You said, okay, God, like if you're up there, or universe, I'm going to do this really moral thing. And I really need you to come through because I need this. And so if I do this for you, universe, right? This is how it works. Give me something in return. And Carson explains that the Bible blows up that kind of worldview. He says, if God made everything and needs absolutely nothing, how on earth do you trade with him? What are you going to trade? He's the author of all things. It's his story. The reason you have breath in your lungs, it's just his grace. What do you have to offer the creator of the universe? He says, already from the beginning, we see the necessity of the doctrine of grace is established by the storyline of the doctrine of creation. This is what God has done. And as we see over the next 6 weeks, I want to give us a preview of how this particular C word, creation, sets the stage to see a God of grace and love and power through the entire story of the Bible. As we close today, I want to invite the worship team up in just a moment. And I want to share with you something amazing about this story. I've told you for this series, we're going to describe this as a story, as a metaphor, and it's got all the elements. Here's the wild thing about this story that makes it unlike any other story that's ever been written. Shakespeare couldn't do this in Macbeth. He couldn't. But our God, who made this story, did something wild. The author of this story, the one who thought it up and spoke it into existence, is the very same God who stepped into this story and became a character in his own story. That's amazing. And it's the climax of this story when God the author becomes God the character. If you will stick with us for these 6 weeks, maybe you've never read this Bible. You have no idea what this thing is about. I promise, I'm asking, would you stick with us for the next 5 more weeks and learn and understand the glory of a God who wrote all things and stepped into the story for you? For you. So as we close our service, I want us now to respond in worship to God's word, to these truths. If God is stirring in your heart, we respond at the end of our service now to celebrate this God. He's amazing. He's authored it all and he stepped into the story. Let's respond, church, and sing to him. So I'm going to ask you, even at this moment, let's stand together, church, and let's respond in praise to him.
This has been a presentation of LifePoint Church. It is our greatest desire that every person would trust Jesus Christ as the leader of their lives and forgiver of their sins. If you would like to make this decision today or find out more, please visit sharethelife.org.